No, thank you very much for the invitation. And you know, many of you do not know where Homburg is, since Homburg has just 40,000 citizens. So, and most of the people mix it up with Hamburg, and Hamburg is here at the coast. So Göttingen is here, and Homburg, this is here. It is at the out, you know, if this is Germany, you know, then it is really at the border of Germany. So it's at the end of the German world. However, it is in the very center of the European world. Yeah, so we can reach Paris in 2.5 hours and Berlin in 1 hour. So I think we are really in the center of Europe. but Berlin in 1 hour, due to, you know, by airplane. And the blue one, this is my GPS track to Santa Barbara. So however, I will not go into detail. Okay. So my own lab is interested in the molecular and cellular mechanisms, how neurons and glial cells interact with each other. And for that purpose, we are applying two different techniques. So one is the generation of new transgenic mouse models, and the other one is the in vivo two-photon laser scanning microscopy. And it's always a pleasure to speak as a gliophysiologist or a gliobiologist in front of a neurophysiology community. In particular, you know, most of the textbooks are somehow neurocentric. So they have the neuron in the very center. However, they do not, you know, appreciate, you know, the beauty of the glial cells surrounding it. And I will talk about astrocytes. You know, these are the cells who are contact to the capillaries, and we heard about that, and we will hear more about it. And they take up nutrients, metabolize them, and then they provide nutrients to the neurons. But not only, they also release glial transmitters, and thereby they are modulating neurotransmission. In addition, we have oligodendrocytes who form the myelin sheaths along the axons to prevent electrical shortcuts, and we have the microglia cells, the immunocompetent cells of the brain. And in contrast to astrocytes or oligodendrocytes, microglia cells are mesoderm-derived, so they are more similar to the monocytes of the blood system. The way we are generating transgenic mice is a very conventional one. We are using a promoter, which is then driving the green fluorescent protein or the red fluorescent protein in a cell-specific manner. So, for example, for astrocytes, we were using the human GFAP promoter, which stands for the astroglia-specific protein, glial fibrillary acidic protein, which is an intermediate filament protein, and most of you know the GFAP immunostainings. For oligodendrocytes, we have used the mouse proteolipid protein promoter to drive expression in oligodendrocytes. And here are some functions of the astrocytes still listed. So they are guiding structures for migratory neurons during development. They contribute to the formation of the blood-brain barrier. They deliver nutrients and growth factors. They regulate ion homeostasis and transmitter homeostasis. They modulate neuronal activity. And during embryonic development, astrocytes in their subform of radioglial cells, they are neuronal progenitor cells.
Are they also guiding structures for the vascular term?
For what?
Are they also guiding structures for the formation of the vascular term?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge. However, they contribute, so they might secrete some of the growth factors which are angiogenic. Yeah, so but they are not guiding structures for the okay, in oligodendrocytes they form and maintain the myelin sheaths, and in addition they also contribute to the iron homeostasis, in particular the potassium homeostasis of the brain. Here are some pictures of the first mouse we have generated. This is the green fluorescent protein in astrocytes, and you see here, you know, as a physicist you would say this is a lambda shaped structure. This is a lambda. Well, okay, I see a lambda. Yeah, if you do not see it, you know. Okay, so, and you know, these are the cell bodies, you have the processes, and you see how the processes nicely attach to the capillaries and surrounding them. And this is, you know, this confocal image was taken in a rather young mouse, so. In later mouse, I will show you an astrocyte in a later in an older mouse. And these are some is an example of oligodendrocytes expressing the red fluorescent protein. In the brainstem, you see how the cell bodies, and you see the myelinating processes of the oligodendrocytes, how they are going along the axons. And since this is a figure from the brainstem, you know you have horizontal and vertical axon projections. Yeah, a few other examples. So these pictures you have already seen. So we have generated now astrocytes also in blue, and this line, you know, is very nicely labeling astrocytes, which are directly attached to the capillaries. This is another blue astrocyte line, which expresses the M-cyan fluorescent protein. And here you see Bergman glial cells, another subpopulation of astrocytes. So, you know, astrocytes come in their classical form. These are the protoplasmic type astrocytes of the cortex or of the conventional gray matter neuropil. And then you have radial glial cells, one during embryonic development, which can give rise to neurons. And you have leftovers in the adult mouse brain, which are the Bergman glial cells of the cerebellum, they are depicted here, and the Müller cells of the retina. And all of them, you know, are fluorescent in one or the other manner. So here, for example, we express the red fluorescent protein in Bergman glial cells as well. And what you also see with all these transgenic mice that you have a cell line or a mouse line specific expression pattern. So you do not achieve 100% labeling of the astrocytes or of the oligodendrocytes in those mouse lines. Well, here in addition, you know, this is a Thy1 EYFP mouse similar to the mice which have been generated by Gu Ping Feng. However, this is, you know, we did this by ourselves. This is a Thy1 EYFP mouse, so which labels neurons. So which is similar to the mice of Gu Ping Feng, so Sens and Lichtmann. Yeah? So these are not glial cells, so these are neurons. From time to time we also have, you know, since we are interested in neuron glia interaction, we are also looking at mice. So for example, then the nice thing is you can play around with the transgenic mice as if you're playing with Legos. Yeah? So you can crossbreed the mice and then you have blue astrocytes in the neighborhood of yellow neurons. Well, here, and this is an in vivo image where we injected a red fluorescent dye into the tail vein, and thereby we are labeling the capillaries, and you see the green astrocytes outlining the vasculature. Here you see another picture of blue astrocytes at the vasculature, oligodendrocytes. And also in the peripheral nervous system, yeah? Yeah. I think it's in the moment our hypothesis is that this is a random phenomenon. You know, you have, let's assume you have all the astrocytes, and sometimes you have, let's say, a more preferential labeling of Bergman glial cells versus cortical astrocytes. Sometimes you have more hippocampal astrocytes than thalamic astrocytes. So I think we are not hitting you know, functionally different subpopulation. I think it's a random event. At least this is, you know, according to our experience. Since we cannot make, you know, we cannot say, well, these are all somehow similar. Yeah, they all are astrocytes. However, we are hitting just by random different subpopulations, which cannot be separated functionally. And I think the very same is true also with the Thy1 promoter. So for example, Pico Caroni generated 80 different mouse lines, and they all have a different expression pattern. While, you know, Gu Ping Feng, Sens Lichtmann, you know, they generated also numbers. So you cannot say that they are functionally different. So within the line, it's perfectly consistent. Yeah, so that's the reason why we have generated the mice by ourselves, so that, you know, we can select for different purposes. We are using different mice. So for example, we have one mouse line in which the axons of the spinal cord are nicely labeled, and others in which we have the majority of cortical neurons are labeled in for the Thy1 mice. And, you know, we have also astrocytes, which were some transgenic astrocyte mice, which are less sensitive to their genetic background. So even, you know, if you crossbreed mice from one strain to another strain to a different background, you can change the expression pattern. No, you cannot change the expression pattern, but the level of transgene expression. Yeah, so for example, we can switch on this blue fluorescent protein. We can switch on and off. However, it's a very slow switch. So if we are crossbreeding this mouse into the C57 background, then the yellow fluorescent protein stays. However, the blue fluorescent protein decays over 10 generations. And then if we start to reintroduce FEBN mouse strain as a background, you know, we can switch on the blue protein again. No, this is our dream that we, at one point, we should see at what position is the gene inserted. This we haven't done yet. Yeah, so it is feasible to do it. However, you know, we were busy with other projects. Yeah. Since it's really interesting, since all the different transgenic mouse lines have a random insertion site within the genome, and therefore, you know, we are affecting different, or there are different neighboring genes. It would be, it's an important question, however, we have not addressed it yet. Okay, so, and then in addition here, for example, we crossbreed this with this, we have the CFP, the GFP, and the YFP. Yeah, in the same mouse. So these are blue Burkman glia cells, green microglia, and this microglia line is comes from David Littmann and Josh and Stefan Jung, Ben Littmann and Stefan Jung, and then our yellow fluorescent neurons. And you see, you know, here these are the mossy fibers of the cerebellum. You see, you can nicely separate them from the green fluorescent protein of the microglia cells and from the CFP of the Burkman glia. So the red neurons is the yellow fluorescent protein. I use just the RGB lookup table. Yeah. So, but you see there's no overlap, so you can nicely separate. However, this has been done with spectral unmixing. Yeah. Okay, if you want to look into the brain, you have to use two-photon imaging, as you know. And, you know, this movie is from Fritjof Hemkjern, where you nicely see the laser focus in a fluorescent medium. And this is an astrocyte, as one would like to see it. Yeah, so astrocytes are highly polarized in the morphology. So, you know, you have here this hand-like structure, which is touching the capillary. And then you have the numerous processes which contact the synapses. And you see independent, what we say, microdomains. So, for example, this thing here, you know, it has a very thin connection to the soma. So it's extremely thin. So therefore, you know, whenever you perform patch length recordings of such a cell, it is completely impossible to record current changes occurring at these distal microdomains. And we think that most of these microdomains are independent in their nature. And that the majority of these second last branching or so, you have mitochondria positioned. So which then, you know, generate the energy needed for the subdomains.
But is there a measurement of the series resistance?
Yeah, the series resistance in the mech ohm range. Yeah, you know, they have a high, you know, this is, you know, when we identify these glia cells. So they do express K-kerns, which have a linear IV relation. Yeah, and in addition, however, they do not express these K-kerns. They also have gap junction hemi channels, and they are connected to each other via gap junctions. So I think, therefore, the electric analysis, or the electrophysiological analysis, can only be done in respect to the soma region. What is happening out there, you know, we also do have only very little information about K-channel distribution along the processes.
I think the lane time has to be very short. Hmm? I think they have to get a really good analysis of what the lane time is.
Yeah. Yeah. You see the major processes, this can be reached, but then, you know, all the secondary and tertiary branches, you cannot.
And do you know what the distribution of
the endoplasmic reticulum is? The ER does not go in the very peripheral process. It stops somehow earlier. So since you know the perisynaptic processes, they are just 30 nanometers in thickness, and they have very little ER. So it stops. So in principle, the perisynaptic processes are clocked or are separated from a major branch with a stalk-like structure, with a stalk. Yeah, you know, and then. When you have these presynaptic processes, you have here a mitochondrion, and then also, you know, this is also the place where the ER more or less stops. You have some, you know, on some of the EM images, you see a few vesicles. Yeah. However, you do not see an ER-like extension. Yeah. So this is also, you know, we are talking about gliotransmission, so vesicular release of transmitters from astrocytes. However, the ultrastructural evidence for that is weak. However, you know, we see astrocytes more as tonic cells, so we do not need an instantaneous release of a high number of vesicles. Yeah, so it's more or less a tonical release.
Yeah, but it's weird, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you can localize the gap junctions all over the cell. Yeah, so let's say you have if you would perform an immunostaining of this cell, you can localize hundreds of gap junction clusters. Yeah. Okay, and this is, you know, I listed this, you know, for those, you know, if you want to identify an astrocyte, so you have this highly polarized morphology, the contact with the blood vessel, K-kerns with the linear IV, water channels, so aquaporins, gap junctions, glutamate uptake, glutamine synthetase expression, GFAP expression, S100 beta. However, not all of them. So you can also find cells which are S100 beta positive, which are not astrocytes. And not all the astrocytes have S100 beta. Not all the astrocytes have GFAP. Not all of them have glutamine. Or let's say the majority are glutamine synthetase positive. So in principle, you have to combine, you know, a subset of these identification parameters to identify an astrocyte. Oligodendrocytes are involved in schizophrenia.
And I'm wondering, are there just a whole bunch of different specific cell types that all relunk into the adaptive types that they're releasing?
Yeah, you know, so what you never see in astrocytes, these are action potentials. Yeah. So I think this is a very clear-cut phenomenon. Yeah, so they do not have, and I think also neurons do not look like this. Yeah, yeah. So this means so these are the main criteria. Yeah, so you have to combine the morphology with the physiology with the antigen expression pattern, and by this three parameters, you can, I think, unequivocally identify an astrocyte. Brian, you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you look at that that list, uptake, lumen synthesis, gas junction, water channels, these are all the defining features of the astrocyte. Absolutely.
Yeah. So in principle, you have three parameters: the morphology, the physiology, and the molecular biology, or let's put it that way, the marker expression. Yeah.
So how does it go and regulate GFAP expression in terms of
autonomic? What is known what GFAP expression regulates?
Yeah, there is no what regulates GFAP expression.
Oh, there are some, for example, IL-6 and LIF, for example, upregulate GFAP, so it's a number of cytokines which upregulate GFAP. So this is the reason why during brain injury, and I will come to that, that astrocytes become activated. And astroglial activation is mainly seen also as a hypertrophy and as an increase in GFAP expression.
It seems like it's really in one cell type or an initial concept. I mean, is there a reason why all of these properties should go together? Is there a reason why?
Yeah, you know, this is what is needed that the neurons can work. You know, we have to regulate, and it's not only glutamate uptake; it's general transmitter uptake. So we need transmitter uptake. The neurons have to be provided with nutrients, and I think this is the way it works. You know, and the neurons can. Yeah. No, the point is that in different brain regions, so for example, the morphology can change from one region to the other. So I've shown you the Burkman glial cells as a more extreme example in the cerebellum. However, you know, they are all this applies to Burkman glial cells as well. Yeah, so they are polarized, contact, cacon, all this. Yeah. So therefore, you go, or the tunny sites, these are astrocytes of the spinal cord. If you take this, you can define it. Yeah?
I don't know if it's possible. Can one take primordial protein glial cells, transpose them into the cortex, and take them out of the system?
These are good according to my knowledge, this experiment has not been done yet. But I don't know what Magdalena Götz is doing anymore. But I think these are really important experiment, whether you're using astroglial stem cells from different brain region, and then you are transplanting them into the cortex or into the cerebellum, see whether, according to my knowledge, there are no data about that. Yeah. Okay, so in addition, I think this is even more complicated. They express numerous transmitter and peptide receptors. And transmitter receptors means not only metabotropic receptors, but also ionotropic receptors. So for example, they express NMDA receptors, AMPA receptors, GABA receptors, serotonin receptors, noradrenergic receptors, etc. Yeah? And many peptide receptors. Yeah? However, the expression pattern of these receptors is more heterogeneous. So this is really in a region-specific manner. So the idea is that astrocytes express those receptors, express receptors for those transmitters which are released by the neighboring neurons. So for example, in the spinal cord, we have glycine used by the neurons. Therefore, they have a higher density of glycine receptors. Yeah? While in the cortex, they do not express. Yeah, they do not have, so astroglial progenitor cells or glial progenitor cells, they express voltage-gated sodium channels, however, at a low density. So, you know, if you measure the host cell current, you end up with a few picoamps. Yeah, well, okay, up to 200 picoamps. However, no action potential.
I mean, the fact that they have high product receptors.
Yeah, no, they receive neuronal information. And so you measure glial EPSCs.
Yeah, glial EPSCs.
Yeah.
That are super magnitude.
No, the magnitude and frequency is not completely identical. But they look like minis. Yeah.
If you look at how many receptors are on astrocyte, this is what we did on the astrocyte. We looked at the GABA receptors. The current density is about maybe 1/8 of the neuronal density. And so you'll still have responses, but it's not going to be as concentrated or localized.
Yeah.
And it'll be smaller, but it's still there.
Yeah, but then in addition, you have to imagine, you know, look at the membranes at the surface. Yeah? So they are not as concentrated as in the spines of a neuron, though, so they are more evenly distributed along the cell surface. However, if you look at the, if you take the surface of the astrocyte into account, they are, you know, they are significantly expressed.
It is more like the receptors.
Yep.
Is there any evidence that they might transfer receptors to neurons?
This has been suggested years ago. This was an old suggestion many years ago, but I think there's no evidence for that.
So the activation of these receptors is thought to be essentially passive.
Yeah. No, I come. So I will talk in the last part of my presentation. I show you some data where we knocked out the AMPA receptors in Bergman glia. And then you see that this has an impact on the behavior of the mouse. Yeah, so they sense neuronal activity and they feed back. However, you know, how this feedback mechanism works, this is not completely clear. Okay. So then, you know, if you look in young slices, for example, So you see that the astroglial processes here, this is a Z-stack of an astrocyte, and you see here some processes surrounding synapses. And you see that they form very thin lamellipodia, which move, and they also have filopodia, which extend and are retracted. Yeah? So you see that even the astroglial processes are dynamic, though they are not still. Yeah? However, they are not as dynamic as microglial cells. I come to that. And No, this is not in vivo. This is in a slice preparation. No, these are 5 microns. Yeah, so the Z stack from there to there is 6 microns, and from there to there is 5 microns. So there's a, you know, and one frame is separated by the other by 30 seconds. Yeah, so these from there to there are 5 microns. And from there to there, 6 microns. Yeah, so they are dynamic. However, this has been done. This is a brainstem slice. However, you see it also in the hippocampus or in the cerebellum. So you know, together with Fritjof, you know, this is the way the collaboration with Fritjof Hemkjön started. So I had this in slices, and we said, well, let's look in vivo. And there, in the living mouse, so the spatial resolution is not as good. So, and the processes are even thinner. So that in the 2-month-old mouse, these processes, they are really hard to detect or to visualize. And so it might well be that in the older mouse, the processes are less dynamic. Yeah. No.
That's not true. Well, like, the impression was that.
No, you have spontaneous. You have spontaneous calcium transients.
You can't actually. You'll get a calcium wave after a brain impression, a damage, or but that it's not a requirement.
Yeah. So, but here, you know, our interpretation is that this is that during development they have to be dynamic. Yeah. So this is, you know, a developmental aspect. Okay. So then, you know, the next three slides I just put in to show you that astrocytes contribute to synaptic plasticity, and this has been shown on three different examples or for three different gliotransmitters. So Alfonso Arag showed that you can, if you increase the calcium concentration in an astrocyte by uncaging, that you get a transient increase at the release probability at the neighboring synapse. And this is mediated via glutamate. Yeah? So, you know, this is baseline control, and then you flash the astrocyte, and then you see the increase in calcium, and you see an increase in the release probability of this particular synapse. And this is a transient phenomenon. No, this phenomenon, yeah, these are 10 millisecond EPSCs you measure in that neuron. However, the release probability, so the increase in the mini frequency, you know, it lasts for about a minute or so, 1 minute, 90 seconds. So it's a transient, it's a sign of short-term plasticity. Then it was Phil Hayden who generated, together with Ken McCarthy, a mouse in which a dominant negative SNARE protein was selectively expressed in astrocyte. And if you measure ATP in these mice in which express a dominant negative SNARE protein in astrocytes, you see that the ATP is impaired. So you have less ATP. And this is due to the release of ATP from the astrocyte. So the dominant negative SNARE protein expressed in astrocytes blocks the vesicular release of ATP. Interestingly, it does not block the vesicular release of glutamate. So this also means that we have different release mechanisms for gliotransmitters in astrocytes. Okay, so this is ATP, and I put in adenosine since the ATP is released, but then due to ectonucleotidases, it's degraded to adenosine. And this effect is more than the adenosine effect. Okay, and then most recently, the work of Stefan Ollier and Dmitry Rusakov, they showed if they impaired the release of deserines, the calcium-dependent release of deserine from astrocytes, you cannot measure ATP in the hippocampus at all. Yeah, so this is ATP in the hippocampal slice, you know, and the orange trace, you know, does not show any ATP, and this is due to the fact that the astrocytes have been clamped in their calcium concentration, and therefore a calcium-dependent release of deserine. And I just show you, you know, you can look into the papers in more detail, but this shows that the deserine released from astrocytes is an essential component for ATP in the hippocampus. Since it's not glycine which acts on the of the neuronal NMDA receptors in vivo, it is deserine. So this means we have three different examples for three different gliotransmitters that astrocytes modulate neuronal activity and neuronal plasticity. Okay, coming back to in vivo image, this is our setup. Okay, this picture was taken still in Göttingen, but now the setup is in Hamburg. And you know this, if you focus along the cortex, you can, and this is a mouse in which the neurons are labeled in yellow, you know, you can go down to 770 micrometers and record, you know, the structure of the neurons. You see nicely the dendrites here and then, you know, the dendritic shaft, the cell bodies. However, if you perform the very same with astrocytes in the cortex, and here in this case, this was together with Axel Nimmerjahn, we injected the astrocyte selective red fluorescent disulfurodamine 101, which is also known as Texas red. You know, all the astrocytes take up the Texas red. And you see, you know, the astrocytes are here on this movie, you know, we converted the lookup tables so that the red sulfurodamine is depicted in green, and then we injected a green fluorescent dye into the tail vein, and so you see the capillaries converted to red. Yeah, so just for consistency with other pictures. And you see down to a depth of a few hundred micrometers, so this is not 100 meter, it's a few miles. You know,
so how much of the glial cell body do you think is being stained by the sulfurodamine?
All of them almost.
No, so I mean like proportion, in terms of how much of the cell, what proportion of the cell, each cell, is it like?
No, so the sulfurodamine is taken up, so and the mechanism, so one idea is that connexins might be, so connexin hemichannels might be responsible. However, we see the very same labeling also in a connexin knockout mouse. Yeah, no, the fine process, I think this is the fine process, you know, it dilutes out to the processes. Yeah, it dilutes, so there's a dilution. Yeah, from towards the peripheral processes. So, but I think this is a matter of, you know, diet concentration. Both can work. Yeah, you can put it onto the pier, and then it goes in, or you can inject it, and then it's distributed. Yeah. No. So if you inject it IV, and so at least in my hands, we have not seen labeling, but.
I tried doing that, and you don't have mindful.
Yeah. So, but you can use this if you impair the blood-brain barrier. So we took the two-photon laser and burned holes into the capillaries, and then you can see how the red fluorescent dye is leaking into the neuropia. Actually, we checked that. So we did immunostaining. Pericytes are positive for the proteoglycan NG2. And we did immunostainings, and we saw only a few percent of the NG2 positive cells which were labeled. And you know, these few percent, we can also say, well, this is an antibody staining problem. So they're only, you know, really a few percent. However, you know, the pericyte, one idea still is, so the connexins are not, so connexin hemichannels are not response or are not involved in the uptake. So one idea now is that panaxins come more as hemichannels, that they are involved. Another idea still is that TRP channels could be the respective, at the very, could be, you know, the entry channel. At the very beginning, we thought that also one ABC transporters, you know, there are hundreds of ABC transporters, that ABC transporter would transport the red dye into the astrocytes. Yeah? You know, and you see, this is it. So if you inject sulfurodamine, then within, you know, well, about a minute or so, you see the extracellular space, and then you see the uptake into the neighboring astrocytes, which takes, you know, here about half an hour.
When you take it into the tissue, do you ever see a kind of reacting in
neuron? No. At least in our hands. So in
you get damage with going down.
Yeah, so but damage. Then you have to damage neurons.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know why are water channels selective for astrocytes, or why are glutamate transporters selective for astrocytes? So I think it is not the dye, you know, just by chance, is recognizing an astrocyte-specific surface protein. Yeah, so it could be, you know, as panaxin It could be trip channels or ABC transporter. I think so. The mechanism. So I think it's not an unspecific uptake. I think it's a very specific uptake system. So, however, you know, and at one point, since I'm a trained biochemist, so I'm discussing this currently with, I'm thinking of putting a master's student on such a project, so to purify the sulforhodamine binding component. Yeah, but this hasn't been done yet. So in all, you know, with the panaxine, these are just circumstantial evidence.
It's also true. If you look at how well oxalate versus nerve cell stain with different dyes too, it's also different from the dye staining.
Yeah, no.
So it's unexpected. There's a lot of examples of some neurons stain better with a different form of an AM dye. And
yeah.
It's unknown.
Also, you all know that if you take Oregon green BAPTA, the brightest cells you get are the glial cells. Yeah, but this is due to the fact that they have a higher density or a higher level of esterases, which cleave the acetoxy methyl ester. So therefore, you have an enrichment of Oregon green BAPTA in the astrocytes. Pardon? No, it does not work. We are using dextrin conjugated sulforhodamine for labeling, let's say, the capillaries, and then even when we are injuring the capillaries, it's not taken up. So dextrin is too large. Oh, we are using, I think, the 5K dextrin. We didn't do, yeah. Okay, so I think this shows you, you know, the dense distribution of astrocytes within a within the cortical column, so to speak. Yeah. So you not only have that many astrocytes, but you know you have about the same number of microglial cells in the same tissue. Yeah, this means any kind of modeling in the nervous system has to include, you know, the microglial cells as well. And I will not talk about it, but there are also other types of glial cells which are called NG2 glia, which are about 1/3 of the density of the astrocytes. Yeah, so you know you have to take into account several cell types. And here, you know, we are focusing also down to the cortex. This is the distribution of microglial cells, you know, down to a depth of a few of 600, 700 micrometers. And, you know, this is the work together with Fritjof. You see how motile these microglial cells are. And actually, this was the reason, you know, we started the collaboration with Fritjof. So I had this motility of the astrocytes in slices. And then, you know, we looked in vivo. We wanted to label the extracellular space. We took sulforhodamine. We saw that sulforhodamine was taken up by the astrocytes. However, they were not as motile in the living mouse. And then we checked whether sulforhodamine would be taken up by microglial cells. And then we crossed. So we took the green fluorescent microglial mouse, injected sulforhodamine. I will show you in a minute. And then the sulforhodamine is in astrocytes. However, you know, while doing the recordings, you know, we discovered that the microglial cells are extremely motile. Although, you know, all the neuroscientists, you know, were talking, or the neuropathologists were talking about microglial cells as resting microglia.
Can you use cranial?
No. So, no, it's not due to the cranial, since, you know, you can play around with the density. You can make either a real cranial window, or you'd make a thin skull preparation, and you can change the density, you know, the thickness. So this is present all over. Yeah? And you see they're constantly monitoring their environment. And here you see we were labeling sulforhodamine as well. So you see the distribution of astrocytes, the distribution of microglia, and at the end you see the sulforhodamine ends up in the processes of the astrocytes which touch the capillaries. So therefore, at the very end, you also see the capillaries here lighting up. And what you see is that the microglia cells, they not only scan the surface of the neighboring astrocyte, the surface of neighboring neurons, they also screen the surface of the capillaries. Yeah, here I think they are. You see it. So microglia cells are constantly monitoring the environment. And
so you follow the trajectory of a single microglia. You follow the
yeah. Yeah, oh, this, you see it here. So on the left you see green microglia, and on the right you see red astrocytes. You know, this, due to the Texas red, you know, this is slightly overexposed, but you know, I think this does. And you see, you know, the Texas red goes to the peripheral processes which touch the capillaries, therefore you see this railway, which is a capillary, yeah? So, and we positioned the laser at this place and increase the laser power, thereby burning a hole into the capillary. And then look at, you know, and the damage starts at about 100 minutes. So, and look at this process here. And now the damage, and you see how the process is migrating toward that area. So normally, under non-injury conditions, so, you know, it's about the volume of the microglia cell, which is monitored. However, you know, if you have appropriate release of attractive molecules, then, you know, microglial processes are attracted over a distance of a few hundred micrometers. And you see, you know, this is the response of the microglia cells at the injured capillary, and this is the response of the astrocyte, so it's not present. Yeah, so the astrocytes do not respond at all, at least, you know, morphologically. Yeah, so you have an increase, so during, you know, if you follow this only for hours, then the cell bodies, they stay at their position. However, I come to that in a minute. So, but then microglia cells, you know, after a few hours, they migrate into the lesioned area. Yeah, extremely anisotropic. You are right. You would expect in the neuropil that it would be isotropic. However, it is not. So there are particular, I think, diffusion barriers within the neuropil. Which could actually be identified by this imaging technique. You know, however, you have to take into account we are now looking here at the green microglia and red astrocytes. We have no idea what about the neurons, some oligodendrocytes, NG2 cells, etc. You know, we are only looking at labeled cells. We do not see the unlabeled cells. Yes, so the microglial, so process extension retraction is about the same time scale as we saw in the slices of the astrocytes. However, you know, in vivo, in 2-month-old mice, we haven't seen this dynamic. Yeah, so therefore, you know, we think, so I think for the young mice, we think it has something to do with the developmental aspect. We do not think that it is just an injury thing. Yeah. Okay. So you see a capillary, and then the microglial processes surround the capillary, thereby shielding the parenchyme, you know, from the damaged area. So the question is whether.
The slices are the radial motility.
Yeah.
In astrocytes, they
were labeled with overloading. No, the astrocytes were labeled with. They were intrinsically expressing the GFP.
Okay, so you know that they weren't there.
Yeah.
Well, the microglia, have you seen microglia in slices for the radial cells?
this is work of others, for example, Etienne Audinat in Paris or so. You can visualize the same microglia motility in slices. Yeah, it is almost consistent. But in slices, you know, the microglia motility was known to exist in slices. However, you know, everyone assumed that this was due to the injury of the slice. Now we know that you can keep slices in conditions in which the microglia cells are not activated. So this surveying behavior is the intrinsic property. Okay, well then we wanted to see whether in white matter the very same could happen. You know, we are looking at the dorsal columns, since you know, in the forebrain, to visualize white matter, it's complicated since it's too deep. However, in the dorsal columns of the spinal cord, the white matter is just at the surface, you know, and you can use, you know, mice in which the axons are labeled, green microglia, you can inject red dye in to label the vessels. And this is the way we are doing it. You see the mouse under the microscope, we have clamps. And actually what we are, for most of the experiments, it's even not necessary to perform a laminectomy. We just bend the back of the mouse a little bit, and then we look into the intervertebral distance. However, okay, we have to remove the intervertebral discs, but then you can directly look onto the spinal cord. So, and then you can close the mouse again, and the mouse, you can watch at the mouse, you know, the next day, the next week, next month, etc. Okay, you know, we do intensive care, so measure heartbeat and body temperature and all this. This is a blow up of the mouse. What is nice, you know, we take the skin of the mouse as observation chamber. So which means, so as borders of it, so we can directly pipette substances, drugs, into this volume and then see how we can affect, you know, activity. With the imaging, in white matter, it's a completely different situation than with gray matter. In gray matter, you can easily go down to 700, 800 micrometers. However, in the white matter, you are somehow stuck to the upper 100 to 200 micrometers. So you see it here, this is the same. You see, you cannot go deeper. So I think this is due to the, well, we do not know whether this is due to the absorption of the myelin, that the myelin absorbs the photon, or whether this is due to increased scattering, so that the emitted photons are somehow absorbed. Yeah, but this is a major disadvantage. What you see is that in the spinal cord, most of the microglia cells have a certain orientation along the axis of the axons, which is nicely seen on this thing. Yeah, so they are elongated and they have process extrusions. And this looks slightly different to, you know, to the cortical. This one here.
Yeah.
This is a monocyte. So in the green microglia mouse, a subset of monocyte are red fluorescent, green fluorescent as well. So these are monocytes. Yeah, since the mouse has been generating by replacing the fractalkine receptor gene CX3CR1 with a green fluorescent protein. And all the images were taken from heterozygous mice. And so far, we do not see any pathology in the heterozygous mice. However, it looks completely different than, you know, the activity in the cortex. So this activity looks isotropic, while this is highly anisotropic. Although the responses of the microglia cells appear anisotropic. And, you know, the process extension and retraction is in the spinal cord, so in white matter, is similar to gray matter. So it's about 1 to 2 micrometers per minute in process extension and retraction. Okay, this is a double transgenic. So you green microglia. So the process follows the axon. Follows the axon, and then the tips the peripheral tips of the microglia cells are scanning, you know, the surface of the axon. So we think that this processes, the tips of the processes are scanning the nodes of Ranvier. So microglia cells have also invertly rectifying potassium channels, so it could be that this contributes to potassium homeostasis. In addition, we know that the paranodal loops of the myelin, they have exosomes, and these exosomes can be shed off, so, you know, as a way of getting rid of debris from the oligodendrocytes. It could well be that the microglia cells somehow phagocytose this cellular debris. No, this is, you know, this is from other data. You know, this is, we think that here is a note of wrong here. From this image, we cannot conclude it. Yeah.
So is that a feeling you have, or is it something that you
don't? No, it looks like that. So since, you know, in some other pictures, you sometimes see that the yellow fluorescent protein in the axon is thinner, or you know, the fluorescence intensity is thinner at the nodes. Yes, so and therefore you know you can measure that and then you see it. We haven't done the immunolabeling for that. Yeah. So what we see is that the tips are always closer to the axon than the rest of the cell. Yeah, so the tips, you know, this was this quantification. Yeah, so here we are measuring the distance of tips towards the axon, so and it's always, you know, the tips of the processes are closer to the axon than the rest of the cell. So we have two hypotheses which we have to prove. One is either contributing to the potassium homeostasis while neuronal activity, since they have invertly rectifying potassium channels. Another point is that at the paranodal loops, the oligodendrocytes have exosomal or exosome vesicles, and they can be shed off. And the question is whether the microglia cells take up those shed off exosomes.
When you did the damage and you saw these, what are those doing?
So now, you know, this is something which is on our list to see. So definitely we think they phagocytose the damaged material. Yeah, I think. However, we have not yet, so we see that material disappears. However, we have not done the experiment really to show that this has been phagocytosed. Yeah, so, but, you know, we see material disappearing.
So I'm not sure if you've seen our paper we had a while ago, or if you block the post coming in and surround the lesion grows in size.
Yeah.
And so within minutes, so this is an addition to the other aspects of transplant, but they actually come in there and they're somehow they're constraining the spread of that lesion material.
Yeah, no, I know that.
They must be. So there's an issue here of attraction. And this is one of the people I called me. There's an education of science. And then there's the issue of contact. And
so, but it's not only ATP and P2Y12, it's also nitric oxide, I'm sure.
But then the contact is another kind of issue, too, that's intriguing. And so there's lots of processes going on, and what Frank's found here is just an incredible, rapid response going in there, and it's stopping the damage from spreading.
Yeah, no.
The requirement of the brain. It's in the gray matter. You can see the lesion get bigger by fluorescent marker indicators.
Actually, in the white matter. If you take a mouse with a sparse labeling of axons, like the GFPM mouse from Saints, and this is the GFPM mouse, you can dissect single axons, and you can look 2 days later, and you see, okay, there's just a little bit of sprouting. And you see that also the rostral part of the You know, if you cut here, then this is the rostral part. You see that this is completely degenerated, Wallerian degeneration, so it disappeared. You know, this is still the cell body, it's located here, therefore this remains. And you know, this is similar as showing here, so the laser was positioned here into the neuropil, and then a laser was, you know, the power of the laser was increased. And you see that only some here, you know, some of the processes of the microglia cells respond, but it's a main process response. You know, this is about 15 minutes. Or this is Windows 7. With Windows XP, I had never problems with my movies. However, you see that also only half of the cell is activated. For example, here you see that these two processes are activated, while you know these processes here are not attracted. Yeah, so you have a preferential diffusion through the tissue. Oh, this we have not tested systematically. But what we did is in this case, so here, you know, at about zero, you know, we are burning two holes into the, you know, you see here. So these are more significant damage. And again, we see the axons in red and the microglia cells in green. And there, you know, you see the process outgrowth, and then within about 2 hours, you also see that the microglia cells migrate into the lesioned area. And here you see this axonal end pipes. So this is Wallerian degeneration of the axons. So this means if you induce a stronger lesion, then microglia cells are migrating into the lesioned area. A small lesion, so it just attracts the processes, but a larger lesion attracts a complete cell. And here you see on the still images, you see, you know, these end pipes, and they are then phagocytosed and disappear. So and we did this. Here in this picture, again, an image, you see processes migrating, well, process growing into the lesioned area. And then, you know, 3 days later, you see this accumulation of microglia cells at the lesion site. And here's another example. Lesion processes grow into the area, and then 4 days later, you have this accumulation of microglia cells. And if you, so and this is, you know, I think this kind of reaction you also observe here in this case where you image just the neurons. However, in this case, only the neurons were labeled. So therefore, you do not see the microglial response. And here is a time series we did on the very same mouse over a period of 3 months. Actually, now we looked at the mouse for 6 months. So we have the astrocytes in blue, the microglia in green, and the neurons in red. The lesion with the laser induces some autofluorescent material, so which can be seen in the blue and in the red channel, but not in the green one. And then, you know, half an hour after the lesion, you see the ingrowth of the microglial processes. 1 hour, and then 1 day later, you see the accumulation of immigrated microglia cells, and you see that the neighborhood is devoid of microglia. So really, microglia cells are migrating from the neighborhood into that area. And this microglial accumulation persists over several weeks and months. Even after 3 months, we are still above background. Yeah, you have to imagine, a lesion with a diameter of 20 to 50 micrometers is sufficient to attract microglial cells and to keep them at that place for such a long period of time. Not many, since, you know, this is here at this time. So within the first 24 hours, this is the immigration. This is not proliferation. For the later days, there might be some proliferation, but at a very low scale. Yeah. So this is somehow seen here. So for example, this is. Here you see after 1 day, you see the axon end pipes, and after 3 days, they disappeared. However, if you look at the blue channel here, which are the astrocytes, you see that the blue is increasing after about 1 week or so. You know, it's the hypertrophy of the astrocytes, the astrogliosis. So we think that, well, we have no idea why the microglia cells, you know, stay that long. However, their stay at the lesion site then subsequently activates the astrocytes. Yeah, so we have, in principle, a lesion is composed of three different phases. The first phase is the attraction of the processes, so the ingrowth of the process. Then the second phase is the immigration of the microglia cells into the lesion site. And then a third phase, so the first phase is within the 2 hours, the second phase within the first 2 days. And then the third phase, which is after a few days, 2 weeks, where we have an astroglial activation. What is happening? So definitely the tissue is somehow, you know, phagocytosed. You know, here you still have some end pipes which are missing. Then here, you know, it's still here, but here it's missing. So it is really, you know, all the dead material has to be phagocytosed. Why it takes that long, I have no idea.
Have you tried any of like 6 months or 5 months or 3 months striking another site of damage nearby to see if maybe the microglia is now sitting there for a long time and lost mobility?
Yeah, this is what we have to do. You know, this is on our list. June?
The
lesion is, you know, we are dissecting, let's say, a few axons, let's say 30 axons in total, you know, since not all the axons are labeled. So yeah, this is the mouse we have generated by ourselves, this Taiwan mouse. We have a higher density labeling of axons than in the Josh Sain's GFPM mouse. We have to, actually, this is something what's also on our list, so that we can somehow trace the axons which we dissect, and to, you know, these are sensory axons. So in principle, you know, at the foot or at the hind paw, so we should be able to see, you know, a reduction in touch responsiveness. You had a question? Okay. Yeah.
Are you able to kind of look at the same axon and see if it's kind of came back as a result?
No, this is now, so definitely axons do not regenerate. In the, you know, we are in the central nervous system, white matter, no regeneration. However, we worked together with Frank Bratke in Munich, and Frank has a so-called preconditioning paradigm. If you stimulate the DRG neurons by dissecting the sciatic nerve, this is done here. Wait a second. Yep. So if you, let's say, before doing the spinal cord lesion, if you cut the sciatic nerve here, and then you do a lesion here a few days later, you get regrowth over the lesion site. So you get regeneration. So you have to somehow activate the DRG neurons with a peripheral injury, and then they convert into regenerative neurons, or into neurons with a regeneration potential. However, you know, for a therapy, this does not make sense. Yeah. So if you are on your motorbike and you know, okay, on Sunday, I will have a spinal cord injury. So therefore, on Wednesday, I have to make a sciatic nerve lesion. So this is not the, you know. However, for experimental purposes, it can be used, since now you can investigate what kind of genes have to be activated in the neurons, and then you know you can ask the question, okay, subsequently, after getting a spinal cord injury, you can say, well, what kind of genes do we have to introduce or to activate into within the DRG neurons so that we get regeneration again?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, if you do this, so but then you would expect to have 100% injury rate, you know. Oops. Okay, Brian was already mentioned this piece of data from Wen Biaogan. So he injected ATP into the neuropil, and you see the injection of ATP immediately introduces this process ingrowth of the microglia cells. And this is almost completely blocked in P2Y12 knockout mice. So you need the P2Y12 receptor on the microglia cells to sense the ATP, which is released by injuries. So also, you know, whenever you perform a damage, cells are damaged and they release ATP, since cells are full of ATP.
ATP is also kind of inducing the tidal wave.
Yeah, so... this we haven't done yet, but it's done by Dustin and Kim. So they showed that if you perform a lesion, you get also a calcium wave in astrocytes, and you get then the immigration of the microglia cells. However, the time course is not completely clear. So you have a very fast, you have definitely an astroglia calcium wave. However, how the astroglia calcium wave is relates to the microglial immigration or ingrowth, it's not completely clear yet. So in our experiments, what we found when we performed the lesion, we saw a vasodilation at the neighboring vessels. And therefore, we thought, well, it might be that nitric oxide might be a component which attracts the microglia cells as well. And therefore, you know, we injected nitric oxide in form of the nitric oxide donor spaminonoate into the spinal cord. And what you see is that the injection causes an immediate immigration of the microglia cells into the injection site. So therefore, the process attraction is mediated via ATP, while the microglial immigration is mediated via nitric oxide, which can be released from the lesioned area as well. So you have you have two different NO synthases which are calcium dependent, and therefore if you are injuring them, you know, they become active due to the increase of calcium, and then they release nitric oxide. Yes, to show you once more. Okay, and the very same the microglia cells immigrate not only if we inject spaminonoate, but also if we inject 8-bromo-cGMP, showing that the complete NO-cGMP pathway is involved. And if we superfuse the spinal cord with spaminonoate, we see also a shape change in the microglia cells. So normally they have this complex structure. In the presence of spaminonoate, several processes are retracted to the soma, you know, and here are two examples. And if we wash out the spaminonoate, you get again see an extension of the processes. So this means, so the spaminonoate also converts the microglia cells into a shape which favors migration. No, we haven't tested it by ourselves, but there are reports that they do express it.
I mean, if they don't express, it's very selective with cell
types. Yeah.
Actually, they have the good insight.
No, they should have. So we did, you know, I just show you this picture. So we did, we can also block this with blockers of soluble granulate cyclase. So we did a complete pharmacology on the NOC-GMP pathway. So in all the data, but for shortness, I just. And actually, which is interesting, if you perform the very same with ATP, so we superfuse the spinal cord with ATP, we see that the complex microglia cells, you know, extend more processes. Yeah. So again, so we have a distinct effect of ATP and nitric oxide on microglia cells. Yeah. No. Exactly. So our idea is that nitric oxide, you know, induces a shape change, and then and this shape change is also inducing then the immigration into or towards the lesion site. However, we have not dissected this. Yeah, but this is, you know, first ATP, then NO shape change and immigration. Since, you know, the NO alone is sufficient for this for immediate immigration of the microglia cells toward, you know, the source of NO. Okay, so, you know, this summary, so microglia cells are active surveyors of CNS white matter. NO and ATP are released. Both are attractors for microglia. However, only NO is, you know, transforms microglia cells into these amoeboid-like cells and attracts microglia cells toward the lesion site. Okay, so I think, so I could talk about transmitter receptor knockout in Bergman glia cells, but I think, what about the time? Okay, wait a second. So, I do it the far, wait a second. Okay, I do this in 10 minutes. Okay. So we are in the cerebellum. So we have the Bergman glia cells. These are the gray processes. This is a three-dimensional EM reconstruction by Jens Groscher. So and these are the synapses of the parallel fiber and the Purkinje cells. These are the synaptic clefts. And the Bergman glia cells tightly enwrapped the synapses. And you see it, you know, and they express numerous sensing molecules, receptors. So Bergman glia cells express AMPA receptors, for example. And in addition, you know, glia cells can release gliotransmitters. I showed you already. So, and if you look more closely at the synapse, at the parallel fiber Purkinje cell synapse in the cerebellum, you see that the Bergman glia cell is enwrapping the presynaptic terminal as well as the postsynaptic terminal. And we have two types of transmitter release from the parallel fiber. So we have the classical canonical release toward the postsynaptic density. However, we also have an ectopic release toward the neighboring Bergman glia cells. And this release to the neighboring Bergman glia induces glial EPSCs, yeah? Which you can reckon. So and there here at this interface, AMPA receptors are expressed at the surface of Bergman glia cells.
So that's just like DM
and yeah. So it is hard to see a postsynaptic density here. So the density is lower than the density is here. Yeah, you see, this is the postsynaptic density, and here you do not have a postsynaptic density. But what you see is that the processes are closer to the presynaptic terminal site. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it's just, you know, the majority of the, you know, you have the readily releasable pool, et cetera, which is here. So you have numerous vesicles that are released, and you have less vesicles that are released at the interface to the glia cell. Yeah? And if you look more closely, so this is an evoked response. So the parallel fiber was stimulated. And if you stimulate the parallel fiber and you wreck it from the Bergmann-Glier cell, you see this AMPA receptor mediated invert current, which can be blocked with MBQX. And this is the work of Greg Sharp. If you perform simultaneously not only this electrophysiological recording, but also calcium imaging from the Bergmann-Glier cell, you see a two-phasic response. So this is a calcium change in the Bergmann-Glier. And the calcium change is composed of two components, this green component here and this orange component here. And the incubation with MBQX of this slice, so this has been done in a slice. So if you incubate the slice with MBQX, you block the AMPA current, and then you lose this green calcium change. Yeah. However, you have this orange change. So, and this is due to purinergic P2Y receptors. Yeah. So you have a huge metabotropic component. So at the stimulation of the parallel fiber, so induces the release of glutamate, but the release of ATP as well. And this ATP activates P2Y1 receptors. But I'm not talking about the P2Y1. So I was asking myself, if we knock out this tiny calcium component, how does this affect the physiology and the behavior of the mouse? Now you can ask, OK, Frank, why are you interested in this little amount of calcium, and why didn't you knock out the P2Y? Good question. But for historical reasons, we were more interested in AMPA receptors. And the project started 13 years ago. Okay, these are the four different AMPA receptors, GLUA 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, and this is the German nomenclature. St. Peter Seebohr cloned it, and he named it ABCD. So this is a German, and I know the Californian nomenclature is GLUA 1, 2, 3, 4. Which is now the international one. Okay, so GLUA, so Bergmann-Glier cells express GLUA 1 and 4 simultaneously. They do not express the GLUA 2 subunit. So therefore, the AMPA receptors of glial cells are calcium permeable, while the neuronal ones expressing the GLUA 2 subunit are calcium impermeable. Yeah, the lack of GLUA 2 determines the calcium permeability. So what we did is we took a so-called Cre-ERT2 mouse. So this is a Cre-LOXP mouse, which is inducible. So we can inject tamoxifen into the mouse, and then the Cre-DNA recombinase translocates into the nucleus and excises LOXP-flanked gene sequences. So for that part, we are using a GLUA1 flox mouse, a GLUA4 flox, a reporter mouse, so incomplete. So you see, this is a more complex breeding procedure. So this has to be homozygous, homozygous, heterozygous, heterozygous. Okay. If you inject tamoxifen, you're just looking at reporter gene activity for the GFAP Cre-ERT2. You see that there's also a difference. So the hindbrain and midbrain is more severely activated or recombined than the forebrain. So this also reflects the GFAP immunoreactivity. So if you perform immunoreactivity stain, then the cerebellum and the mid and hindbrain have a higher density of GFAP than the forebrain. Yeah? So, but it also shows that within a few days, you know, we get recombination in the mice. Actually, here it's done at a single cell level. So we inject tamoxifen into the mouse, and already after 4 hours, we see the first Bergmann-Glier cells in which the Cre-DNA recombinase has excised flox sequences. So, but here this is reporter gene activation. So here you see only a few cells expressing the reporter genes, and we see an increase. And then within 14 days, you know, all the Bergmann-Glier cells show the reporter gene activation. Similarly, we are looking here at the mRNA level. So after 3 days, you see of tamoxifen injection, we see a reduction of GLUA1 of 90% and GLUA4 of 64%. However, you have to take into account we cannot excise down to we cannot excise 100% of the mRNA. So this reduction of mRNA by 89% reduction by 64%. We cannot get 100% reduction due to the fact that granule cells, stellate and basket cells, etc., they do express AMPA receptors as well. And you know, the mRNA data are derived from cerebellar homogenates, while the expression analysis, so the reported gene, was at a cell level. However, then we also looked at the protein decay, and here we are looking at mice which are just 2 weeks old, so young mice. We inject the tamoxifen, and we see a decline in the GLUA1 and GLUA4 expression level. Here's, these are overviews, and here in more detail, you see that after 9 days post-injection, only very few cells still express GLUA1 in this case, or GLUA4 in this case. Here, this is the reduction in the protein. You see, we get a protein reduction down to 94%. You know, and this has now been investigated at the Bergmann glial cell level. Yeah, so only 6% or 8% of the AMPA receptors are left in a single Bergmann glial cell, while measured by no number of cells expressing the protein. If you perform the very same experiment in 2-month-old mice, so this was done again, one in young mice, so 2-week-old, you see a significant reduction after 9 days of the protein. In 2-month-old mice, you have to go for 3 weeks. So it takes a much longer time for the protein to decay. In addition, you also see that the decay curve for GLUA1 and GLUA4 is somehow different. So although the two genes, the GLUA1 and the GLUA4 gene, have the same genomic organization, the accessibility for the Cre DNA recombination is different. So which means whenever you want to knock out in a cell, you have to look for your particular gene of interest. This data in the 2-month-old mice shows you the DNA recombination. So this is at the genomic level. At the genomic level, you see that already after 12 hours, we can achieve 64%. However, at the mRNA level, we go, we have to go the maximum, the saturation level, down to the mRNA. So this means 64, so we are zero here, and 64% of the locus is regenerated. So within 24, 48 hours, we have complete excision of the gene in Bergmann glial cells. However, the mRNA takes about 7 days to be degraded. And as I showed you, the protein takes about 2 to 3 weeks to become degraded. So you have a very fast gene excision, a slower mRNA decay, and an even slower protein degradation. Yeah? Yeah. No. The Cre is transcribed all day long. Yeah. So the translocation of the Cre into the nucleus has to take place.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Okay. So the
Cre activity is fast. Yeah. So it's within 1 or 2 days you have a complete excision of the gene or of the gene fragment. However, then it takes a few days for the mRNA to be to decay, and even longer for the protein to be degraded. Yeah.
So I know there's a cycle
for
within a few hours.
Yeah.
Does it mean it's much slower here?
Yeah. So and we see it's the older the mice are, the slower the degradation is. So in younger mice, we have a higher turnover rate than in more mature, in older mice. Okay, so this is another one showing you, this is the decay of the protein in adult mice. This shows you that we have a preferential degradation in the cerebellum, but not in the hippocampus and cortex. We have some degradation in the brainstem, which shows you the cell type specific expression pattern of our transgene. What is the effect? So if you induce the GLUA2 subunit into Bergman glia cells and thereby rendering the AMPA receptors from calcium permeable to calcium impermeable, you get a retraction of processes, as it has been shown by Seiji Ozawa. And we looked at the EM level as well. So here you see how the synapses are enwrapped by the Bergman glial processes. And in the knockout situation, the processes are retracted from the synapses. Yeah, so we have a retraction of the process from the synapses. And if we look for electrophysiology, we see an increase in the EPSC amplitude of the Purkinje cell, an elongation of the amplitude. This is the elongation and this is the increase. However, we do not see an effect on paired pulse facilitation or long-term depression. But you would expect that if the processes with the glutamate uptake capacity are retracted from the synapse, you have less glutamate uptake, you have more glutamate in the synaptic cleft. Okay, and then we did a behavioral experiment where the mouse is placed into such a box, and then we convinced the mouse to run along this horizontal ladder. And to do that, you know, the mouse receives a tailwind, and then the mouse is running along this ladder to this box, and then another tailwind starts and the mouse has to run along that direction. Tailwind. We just induce wind into the box. Wind. So we blow wind into the box. So this somehow, you know, makes the mouse running along the, you know, and so you do this 72 times, so the mouse is running back and forth. Huh? Yeah, no, not fear condition. No, you know, the wind is just to change the mood of the mouse to run along this.
How reliable is that?
Oh, no, you know, it looks like, you know, the mouse is running along the ladder, you know, and all the keys of the ladder, they have touch sensors. So we know exactly where the mouse is while running along the ladder. You know, and then we can predict, okay, when the mouse is running with a constant speed, you know, we can calculate, well, at that particular point of time, it will be here, you know, and then we can induce, you know, some kind of obstacle. Yeah? So, and we can combine this. So first the mouse has to learn how to run along this ladder, and then we can do some pairing paradigm here with the tone. Yeah? So, but at the, you know, this is a naive mouse, and if we go one step further, you know, the tone, you know, and now the mouse. However, actually, this experiment is done not in the way, you know, that we lower a key, but rather that we lift the key. So the mouse is running against the key. So which means that then the mouse has to circumvent the obstacle, and you know it has to climb across the obstacle, which is, you know, a more sophisticated motor coordination task. And you know, yeah, this is the learning period. So the mice, all knockout mice and the various control mice, they learn to run along this ladder. Then we inject tamoxifen and we knock out the genes, and you know, then you know the mice do a higher failure rate. However, they still are more or less similar, knockout mice and control mice. If we look just a few days after the injection, so here we inject and then this is a few days later. After 2 weeks of injection, you know, we see a separation, a statistically non-significant separation of the populations. And after 2 or 3 months, we see that the knockout mice you know, have an impairment in the motor coordination by, you know, climbing across the obstacle. So this clearly shows that a glial AMPA receptor, you know, contributes to the proper motor coordination or to a behavior phenotype in a living mouse. And with that, you know, I come to the end. So, okay, we can delete GLUA1 and 4 in Bergman glia. And we have a behavioral phenotype in adult mice, so impaired learning of motor coordination. And with that, I come to the end And this is my group. Yeah, no. So the behavior experiments were done in mice which are 2 months. We started the experiments 2 months old. So in there we know, actually we did, you know, also EM studies on the different time points. And so it really takes the time for the protein to decay and then the processes to be retracted. And then, you know, we have some kind of network change. So now one question I did not answer. So what, you know, I showed you that the amplitude of the Purkinje cells is increased in the knockout situation. However, how the network activity of the Purkinje cells is affected and how this change in network activity contributes to the impaired learning, we have no idea. So that's the reason why we have to talk to the neurophysiologists of the cerebellum. Yeah? No, I think no. They express GluaB, I think. So they express GluaB. So they are calcium impermeable. So I have to look. I think in the cerebellum only the Burkman glial cells have the calcium permeable one. Yeah. I show you next year, since I wrote a grant, you know, on doing sparkles and flares and bursts in. No. Sparkles, bursts, and flares are glial calcium signals. They are Burkman glial calcium signals, but they are differently dependent on glutamatergic and purinergic signaling. Yeah, no. But the flares are, you know, the flares depend on motor onset, on movement onset. So therefore, you know, we have a very high probability that the flares might be affected in these mice. So, you know, this is a grant I've written, and I hope November 16, then I learn whether I get the money. So you're first.
So a question about the timing. I got lost track of the timing too. So is it well correlated, the timing of the decrease in the expression in the Burkman glial cells and the development of the motor impairment, or is there a delay in motor impairment?
Yeah, no. The protein decay takes 3 weeks. Yeah, but the behavioral impairment we see. So after 3 weeks, we see that the cohorts have a tendency to be separated, but this is still at a non-statistically significant level. Even, you know, I showed you the data for 25 days and 85 days. We also have data for 45 days, and they are exactly in the middle. So I think, you know, as we have a fast gene excision, slower mRNA decay, slower protein decay, slower behavioral phenotype. So I think there's really, you know, a series of events. But the
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So therefore, you know, we try to do also some telemetric recordings to see whether, you know, some kind of network activity is impaired in those mice. And I think you.
Yeah. In terms of the health response. Right. In terms of the calcium response, what contributions
are there out there? So Burkman glial cells do not, although there's one report, but Burkman glial cells do not have NMDA receptors. I think let's say at least in the cortex, 1/3 of astrocytes express at least NMDA receptors, and they have calcium. You can visualize calcium transients at the most distal processes. However, so far, you know, we have not done an NMDA receptor knockout. We did an NMDA receptor knockout for oligodendrocytes, and we will do one for the astrocytes, but this we haven't done yet.